Question we're considering, how will people remember you? How will people remember you? I guess there will be different possibilities. It may be something connected to an achievement. Captain of the team, the head of the firm, things like that. It may be something related to what they know you really care about. Ah, he was a total workaholic, a family man. The life and soul of the party, something like that. Maybe instead by what we stand for. I gather that newspapers, when they're putting together sort of summaries of people's lives, obituaries, they make sure that famous people are written about long before they die and that obituaries are updated regularly. I think the Queen's obituary gets attention from most papers every week, at least I heard from somebody who writes obituaries the other day. Well, just imagine for a moment that your life was worthy enough for the local press to take interest when you died and that they wrote an obituary. What would a local hack who was given the job of investigating your life just after you die, what would they conclude about you? I mean, the journalists would want to know what really made you tick. They'd want to build up a picture of how you spent your time and your energy and your resources. They'd go to your family and friends for sure. They'd ask them questions that were appropriate after your death. They'd go to your colleagues, if they could find them, and ask them questions of what sort of things you talked about in the office and what you got excited about. And let's just say that this hack, because he really wanted to make a name for himself, let's say he hired a private investigator too to dig up details of your life through your social media profile, through your financial records, through personal details, all of this sort of stuff. I don't think it would be too hard, would it, to piece together a pretty accurate picture of what you really cared about. I know that the journalist, if he's worth his salt, would want to then distill it all down to an idea. This person, this is what summed up their life. I mean, think back to other people, some that have died, some that haven't. We already know, don't we, when it comes to someone like Boris Johnson, the defining feature of his life is obviously going to be his sort of mop of hair. I mean, that's how he's going to be remembered for all the other sort of things. That's how the sort of picture is going to go down in history. Other more serious people that have died, think of Jimmy Savile. He's going to, for all the things that he might have done, certainly as I was growing up, the idea of providing these sort of charitable services, all of that is completely irrelevant. He's an abuser, and that's how he will be remembered. What about Theresa May? Not dead yet, let me clarify, as far as I'm aware, but she's going to be remembered for the failed Brexit deal. That's what's going to go down, I guess, in her obituary, and so on. We could carry on. What about you? What will you be remembered for? Well, in this section that we've just heard read, what we see is sort of an eye into what Paul really cares about. It's the first thing that he gets to. Do you remember, if you were with us last week, the letter written to the Philippians, there isn't a big correction going on. There wasn't a problem that Paul is writing to correct. Instead, the Philippian church, they were going well. Paul's writing to encourage them. And here, all through the passage we just heard read, you can see what's on Paul's mind. End of verse 12, what does he care about? The advance of the gospel. End of verse 14, people are more bold to speak the word. End of verse 18, only that in every way Christ is proclaimed. In other words, the gospel made known, and in that rejoice. You see, all Paul really cares about is that people come to know Jesus Christ. All he really cares about is that the gospel goes out. And he makes sure that whatever happens in his life, good or bad, that this will happen. Now, that's particularly interesting as we read through the book of Philippians, because what we see by the end of the book is that Paul says, actually, by the way, guys, you should see me, Paul, as an example of how to live. Just flick with me. I think you just need to glance across to chapter 4, verse 9. Sorry, flick over the page, chapter 4, verse 9. And Paul says, what you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice these things. Now, that's not always the given. I mean, Paul's a set-apart apostle, so we shouldn't take it that he acts in every case, in every other letter, as a model. Sometimes he is writing to correct, instruct, that sort of thing. Here he says, what you have learned, received, heard, and seen in me, practice these things. And so our passage today sets the overarching agenda for what Paul really cares about. This is what makes him tick. He's passionate about the gospel going out. And I think this passage is particularly poignant because whilst that point comes clearly through, the backdrop is persecution, suffering, setback. And there are two ways we're going to see that. Trouble from secular authorities. I mean, the salient reality is he's in prison as he writes this letter. He has trouble. But also, a bit of a shock, he's actually having trouble from within the church as well, perhaps the wider church. I don't think he's pointing fingers at the Philippians particularly, but he wants the Philippians to know that there is trouble coming from within the church, which is a little bit strange. We'll need to think about that in a minute. But what does Paul do with both of these situations? Trouble from outside, trouble from inside. What does he do? He says, well, rejoice. We need to rejoice. And you might expect, I mean, I think if I was in prison, I'd be writing to guys that I knew and say, hey, look, please, can you please pray that I'm going to get out? Can you please sort of, you know, lobby the local government or whatever it's going to take? I'd want my Christian friends and family and my wider sort of contacts to say, please get me out of here. But Paul doesn't even raise that as a possibility. He wants to prioritize the main thing, get the gospel out. And I think these sort of negative circumstances in Paul's mind are just further opportunities for the gospel to advance. And that is a fascinating way of seeing setbacks and difficulties, isn't it? And so I think that the big sort of implication that runs through this section, if you were with us last week, you'll remember that the book is primarily about having the right mindset. Having the right mindset means that we're in partnership together. People with the same mindset are in partnership, gospel partnership, focused on Jesus. With that mindset, well, what Paul is doing by implication in the section, whatever happens to you in life, if you have this mindset, you don't need to worry, because there will be an opportunity to carry on doing the very thing that you most care about. Because every opportunity gives you opportunity to carry on with that focus. Which is really quite radical, isn't it? So let's try and sort of look at this in a bit more detail. We'll slow down a little bit and see just how it is that even being in prison means you can still carry on with your primary ambition. Fascinating. Trouble from outside the church. Verse 12. I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. So Paul, he's in prison in Rome. He's probably under house arrest. He's almost certainly facing the death penalty. That's certainly the idea you get as you carry on reading the letter. He's expecting to die soon. What does it mean to be under house arrest? Well, probably guards posted to watch his every move, quite possibly chained to Paul. That would have been certainly not out of step with normal Roman practice to have somebody on rotation sort of chained to Paul the whole time. He obviously had a certain amount of freedom. They obviously didn't see him as a sort of a threat to sort of running away or attacking, and so he was able to write letters, perhaps receive guests, that sort of thing, house arrest. Does Paul see this as a setback? No. Why? Well, what he's excited about is what's happened as a result of being in prison. Verse 13, he's sort of saying, let me tell you guys about what's happened since I've been in prison, so that it, that is the gospel, has become known throughout the whole imperial guard. That is incredible, isn't it? The gospel has been made known to the whole imperial guard. Doesn't mean everybody's received it. Doesn't mean everyone's become a Christian. But it means it's been made known. Now, commentators estimate that at this stage in Rome, there were probably 9,000 members of the imperial guard. It's an estimation. We don't know for sure. But even if it was a tenth, 900, I mean, that would still be remarkable, wouldn't it? Paul's imprisonment has given him an amazing opportunity. And it's not just the imperial guard, not just the 9,000 of them. Look at verse 13 again. The whole imperial guard and to all the rest. The imperial guard in Rome would have been, pretty significant members of society. They would have had families, they would have had connections everywhere. And Paul's saying, yeah, all the rest too. The gospel has been made known to a very wide group of people. Join with me, rejoice. That's the message to the Philippians. I mean, put yourself in Paul's shoes just for a moment. Sandals, I should probably say. Imagine guards being chained to Paul or sort of stationed nearby. And you know it's going to happen because you've heard from your sort of fellow guards that every time you go into Paul's house, without fail, he bangs on about Jesus, tells people the gospel. You can almost imagine him trying out his different sort of gospel outlines and thinking, oh no, I've heard this before 1,000 times. Maybe reading out his letters. Oh, if I hear that letter written to the Philippians again. But Paul wants us to know, verse 12, I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. So, here he is, conveying to his Christian readers the thing that most matters. And look at verse 14. What has this done? Well, it creates confidence and boldness to speak even more. Verse 14, and most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. That is a fascinating sort of knock-on effect, isn't it? Paul's in prison and other people say, oh wow, I'm going to be even more confident now to go and tell people about Jesus. I think we see this in all sorts of ways, perhaps in our own experience or certainly sort of through history. There are lots of examples of how this sort of knocks on. I'll give you a few just to help to ground this point a little bit. You'll know that one of my favorite missionaries that I refer to from time to time in examples is Jim Elliot. We've got lots of books that relate to Jim Elliot on the bookstall there. Amazing missionary that was operating relatively recently. Sort of 50s, 60s was the time that all of that was going on. He was actually killed in the 60s. And significantly, he was killed before he had the opportunity to actually share the gospel with a group of people in Latin America that he's trying to reach, the Orca people, who were an unsort of touched member of the sort of wider Amazonian people of the time. And nobody from the West had ever sort of met them. Certainly, as far as they were aware, the gospel had never been explained. And Jim and his fellow missionaries managed to get close to this people, and he was killed along with everybody else. I think there's a group of 5 or 6 of them. They were all killed with spears before any words were actually spoken. Now, what effect did that have on other people? Well, lots of people, it had a huge impact. I mean, it was hitting the front pages of the newspapers all around the world just after it happened. Lots of people from his university, he was at Wheaton University in Illinois, on hearing the news of his death, other Christians thought, right, well, we're going to go on, carry on. This is amazing that this has happened. What boldness. And it inspired another generation to get up and go and take the gospel. And amazingly, Jim's father was one of those people. And Jim's father then took the gospel and found the very man that had killed his son. And in time, lots of members of the tribe, including the man that killed Jim, were converted by many who went back emboldened. This is the testimony of one of the men that threw spears in the first instance. And he said this quite a few years later. He said, I've killed 12 people with my spear, but I did that when my heart was black. Now Jesus' blood has washed my heart clean. That's a wonderful thing to be able to say, isn't it? Full forgiveness. And that was as a result of people being emboldened by this setback, this persecution. I don't know what sort of experiences you've had of this. I remember an experience that I had while I was in the secular job back in the days when I had a real job before church work. You may remember the dreadful shooting that took place in America in Columbine High School. It was in 1999. And again, front pages of all the newspapers. One of the facts that particularly attracted journalists to this story, I mean, it was terrible. 15 children were shot in this high school. But apparently, the two gunmen that went around doing this were asking the kids whether or not they were Christians before they were shot. And as these children were looking down the barrel of a gun, their testimony determined whether or not they would be killed. And many paid the price, ultimately. And I just remember that had a huge effect on me, just thinking, wow, here are children prepared to stand up to gunmen, knowing almost certainly what's going to happen. And that certainly had an emboldening effect on me in the workplace, as I faced sort of, you know, sneers and lost reputation and so forth from colleagues. It's been famously said, hasn't it, that the blood of the martyrs is the seedbed for the saints. And I guess that's true again and again. We can be inspired by other people's sacrifice. What about you? What do you most care about? For Paul, trouble from outside is just another opportunity to speak about Jesus. Well-known evangelist John Chapman, he's an amazing man. I say he is. He has actually gone on. He's been promoted to glory. He died some years ago now. But he had a huge impact on many within our sort of wider church constituency. Just a wonderful way of helping Christians relate the gospel to the world around, to make it credible and compelling as we just have natural conversations. And he used to have this phrase. He used to say, every conversation that we get into as Christians, whatever our situation, every conversation is a potential opportunity for the gospel. And it's just a wonderful mindset, isn't it? That's the sort of mindset that Paul would be sort of, you know, cheering in the background. Absolutely. Every conversation. John Chapman then qualifies. He's not saying every conversation should necessarily lead to a conversation about the gospel. But it's just that mindset of thinking, well, maybe there'll be an opportunity now to tell this person, this client, my boss, this colleague. We must move on. So we've seen that even through trouble from outside, from secular authorities, what happens? Well, the gospel goes out. What about from inside the church? Verse 15. Some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. The latter will do it out of love, knowing that I'm put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of rivalry, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. You'll see I've called this point trouble from inside the church. It would seem that there are people, Christians, who are causing trouble for Paul. And Paul uses this phrase, they're teaching, they're proclaiming Christ out of envy and rivalry. What Paul is doing here is talking about the motives that they're using for spreading the gospel. It's a really strange idea. Let me try to sort of break it down a little bit to hopefully make it make more sense. I mean, these are Christians who've probably found themselves in some way or other in the shadow of Paul. And they don't like it. Perhaps they don't like the sort of the lack of attention. I mean, there they were sort of faithfully plugging away in whatever sort of ministry they'd been given. And along comes Paul. And what happens to Paul? Well, Paul has suddenly got all of the Roman guard and many others talking about the gospel as a result of his ministry. And it seems like some have been sort of slightly narked by this. And you can imagine some of the chat that might sort of follow as a result of that. Well, Paul's in prison now. He always had it coming, didn't he? Man like that. You could see it coming. It was bound to happen in the end. He just didn't know when to stop. He just kept on banging on about the very thing that's landed him in prison. And I think we can relate to that sort of idea, can't we? Of just feeling sort of undervalued, not appreciated. We can certainly relate to it in sort of other areas of life. And it seemed to be happening here. And I think it's only a small step there from wanting to sort of slightly redirect the spotlight back on us. Say, well, by the way, didn't you know? I mean, I've been plugging away in a very similar way for some time now. You don't see me in prison, do you? From there, well, just another small step. I mean, don't you think it could be suggested? Don't you think he was going about it the wrong way? I mean, he always insisted on putting people's noses out of joint. Was it really necessary? Well, he's in prison. What do you expect? But the amazing thing is, you see, when you have a mindset like Paul, you're not going to be in the slightest bit worried about what others are saying. Amazingly, Paul even finds reason to rejoice in those people who are being critical of him or seeming to sort of find Paul a bit of a rival because the gospel is still going out. So where does this leave Paul? Well, that's the third and final point. All that matters in his mindset is that Christ is proclaimed. That's where verse 18 lands. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice. I think that's the big challenge as we draw to a close now, as this section ends. Christ is proclaimed. I mean, that is what Paul wants to be remembered for. And it makes so much sense, doesn't it? Because everything else in life, of course, can be ruined, will come to an end. That's maybe a question just to sort of think about as we draw stumps in just a moment. I mean, what ambition can you possibly have in this life that can't ever be ruined? Whatever happens, what ambition can you possibly have that can't ever be ruined? And the point here is not that just that Jesus has become not just a competing care in my life. I'm interested in X, Y, Z, and Jesus. The point that's being made here is that Jesus is the primary concern, and that all other competing sort of areas that want our attention are then analyzed and understood with relation to Jesus, because Jesus is his ambition. I mean, all through our passage today, Paul is describing what it means to have a life with Jesus as our primary concern. And he can't think of any better way than using his life to talk about Jesus. And so, that question one more time. How will people remember you? That's something just to bounce around and think about a little bit. Hopefully the question's there at the bottom of the handout. Paul, how does Paul's example challenge us? That's pretty obvious, I hope, from what we just said. But this may be a good one to start, the second one there. Why are we sometimes reluctant to adopt a gospel-centered mindset? It might be useful if you've got a few moments now. Anyway, I'm going to hand back to Mikey just to close our meeting together. Thanks for joining us today.